Tim Goodman's TV Talk Machine is brought to you by Mack Weldon. Mack Weldon, they sell underwear, shirts, socks on the internet. And what their stuff is, it's better than whatever you're wearing right now. There's smart design, premium fabrics, simple shopping, super easy. You click around, find some beautiful stuff. Stripey socks. I love their stripey socks so much. I am addicted to them. I wish they made different, more kinds of them, because I would just lose all my money buying socks at Mack Weldon. You click a couple of times and they show up at your door. It's super easy. And if you don't like your first pair, you keep it and they'll refund your money because they want you to be comfortable. They don't want you to be freaked out about buying clothes on the internet. All their products smell great. Not just because they're made of good materials, but because they're naturally antimicrobial, which means they eliminate odor. Mack Weldon's underwear, socks, and shirts look good. They perform well, great for working out, going to work, going out on dates, living your life. So go to MackWeldon.com. That's MackWeldon.com. Get 20% off your order using the promo code TVTalk. Mack Weldon. I'm not giving too much away by saying I am wearing Mack Weldon socks right now. Can you hear them? This is a man who's wearing some good socks. Welcome back to the TV Talk Machine. It's episode number 68. It's going to be the punch drunk edition, possibly. I'm Jason Snell. Laughing on the other side of the internet is Tim Goodman from The Hollywood Reporter. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Jason. How are you doing? I really botched that opening.
You're just laughing. No, that's the kind of entertainment that that this podcast provides, is you're already entertained just by being here.
Yes, I am just...
getting back in the swing of things?
Yes, I kind of am. I think even though just 2 minutes ago I couldn't remember anything about last week's podcast, I feel like I've got it. I have the wherewithal to tell you that I'm back.
Yeah, I feel like you're you and the listeners might be similar there. Just like what happened last week? I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah. I should retweet all those out again. I might do that and do a double thing. Hey, just like catch up, people. You know what that is? They probably like left us on the DVR, basically, quote unquote. Yeah, we're on the pile, and then they're gonna catch up.
You know, there is a too much TV problem with podcasts. There are too many podcasts now, too. There's a huge glut of podcasts.
There are a lot of podcasts.
There are a lot of podcasts out there. So we appreciate the time that you people spend listening to us, because you are listening now. If you're not listening, then you wouldn't hear us saying what we're saying. So
exactly.
Thank you for giving us your attention.
And that is really smart, because that is really true. And, and by the way, I mean, not to like point fingers or anything, just as an aside, but boy, you really contribute to the glut, don't you?
I do.
You are one of the it's like if there was a bank robbery and there were suspects, your picture would be in the paper,
probably.
Yeah. You probably. And like the Nerdist people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's right. I read the other day that the Nerdist started only about like 6 months before The Incomparable did, and I had that moment where I thought, well, you know, His podcast got more popular than mine, but I looked at, you know, but he also knew everybody. Like, his guest list is hilarious. It's like, even from the beginning, he was having all these star, you know, media personalities on, and it's like, well, must be nice to be Chris Hardwick.
Yeah. It was kind of crazy. He was plugged in.
Yeah. Well, that's the trick. He knows a lot of people.
Yeah. And I know a lot of people. I'm just lazy.
That's fine. That's fine.
Yeah,
we got the TV Talk Machine. I wouldn't do it any other way.
I wouldn't do it any other way.
Got a lot of stuff to talk about. New shows that you've reviewed or are in the process of reviewing. I wanted to start by going back to the X-Files, which you saw that clip at the TCA in the summer, and said that you and a lot of other people thought maybe it was a joke. But it wasn't a joke. It was actually a scene from the show. And then, you know, that was a bad sign. And then you reviewed the opening episode and said it was no good. And awful. I watched it on Sunday. And that I cannot believe they used that scene on the porch as the thing they showed to critics, because it is the worst thing in that episode.
Yeah.
And the episode's... The episode's not good. I kind of want to say it's you succeeded in lowering the bar for me expectation wise. So I didn't find it terrible, but I found it X-Files in the way that so much of the conspiracy stuff of the X-Files always was, which is like ridiculous. And I kind of just shake my head and I'm like, whatever, move on, show me another monster. I found it kind of consistent with the ridiculous stuff that they tried to pull with, and I loved the show, but the Chris Carter episodes about the mythology were just as ludicrous then as they were now. So I felt on one level, it's like, yeah, okay, you know, you're giving people what you gave them 10 years ago, 15 years ago, which is the same thing. But that scene when they get to the scene on the porch where it's like, let's use all the catchphrases now. So painful.
Well, did you not think though that the actors were, I felt like they were running like a beat or two slower than they normally do.
Maybe. I was struck by how, I had to remind myself, I was struck by how laconic David Duchovny is. Mm-hmm. But having just watched, for The Incomparable, we watched four old X-Files episodes a couple weeks ago and did a podcast about it. And you know what? He was always like that. That's like, that's his bit on The X-Files is Mulder is like that. He's kind of flat and laconic. That is his thing. But you could tell that they're kind of like getting up to speed. It seemed the chemistry wasn't intense. There were moments, there were flashes, I thought, but I think it's one of those examples where maybe it just picked up where it left off, but where it left off wasn't a very good place. So,
And I just thought they looked bored out of their minds. And some of that, this is, as somebody who's also aging, I can tell you that this is not an ageist comment. Part of it is that they're older.
Yeah.
And so when Duchovny is, you know, much, much younger and playing that role, he looks laconic. And when he's older and haggard, more haggard looking, he looks bored.
Bored, disinterested. I thought Gillian Anderson was better. I think what they did with Scully, where she's moved on with her life, mm-hmm. and she's like sort of volunteering at the where they're doing surgery on like these kids and stuff like that. I thought that was good because then, but what I sort of wanted was her to be more. I don't know. I kind of wanted her to be more dragged into it a little more reluctantly and have her be a little more almost thinking that Mulder is just sort of sad for going back over this ground again. I kind of wanted her to judge him a little bit more, but I feel like that would be judging Chris Carter a little bit. And so, you know, since he wrote it, that wasn't going to happen, but that's kind of what I wanted because she's the adult in that relationship, right? She's the one who's got the kind of real world. She's dealing with the real world and he is dealing with this sort of fantasy world that he lives in. But I don't know, you know, I'm going to keep watching it because there are only six of them and I love the original series and I'm hoping we'll get some, eke out some good material in there. But, you know, it is what it is. And I feel like, you know, people who expected something, I mean, you would hope there would be some growth and progression over the course of the years. But in reality, I think they're picking it up just at the point where they left off, which was not a particularly high point in the series. So,
yeah. And I think too, part of what I hadn't actually thought about that whole thing where he could, you know, he can't have her judge him because that's a self-judgment thing. It's interesting. I just also think that with six episodes, there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, that she can't be resistant for too long. Everybody, I think that was worked against them. You know, the whole, like, he's been hiding for all these years and all of a sudden he's like, yeah, okay, this internet kook says, let's do it. Let's do it. Yeah. I'm not going to do it alone. And then she joins me. Everything was just too quick. But that is probably a product of how many episodes there are. And you know, like I said, everybody, people that I trust and we'll see say the next episode's slightly better.
We'll see.
And that the third one is very, very good. So we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. I wanted to ask you, though, on a larger point, this is one of these revivals. There's the Twin Peaks revival. There's the news broke as we were getting ready to do this they already said, Netflix already said they were going to bring back Golden Girls. That would be, it's Golden Girls, except with the cast of Gilmore Girls. That would be something. They're bringing back Gilmore Girls and Lauren Graham's coming back. The whole cast is coming back. And it just made me think again, like we are really in an age of revivals of classic shows. And, you know, Britain has been doing this all along. They do Christmas specials and other specials of beloved TV series for years afterward. But in the U.S., it feels like this is now officially a trend that all of these old shows are getting dusted off and either rebooted or now like just being brought back with original people involved, which is so what's is this. You know, what are the creative ramifications of that for you? I mean, the X-Files is the good example of, like, was this worth everybody's effort to do this? And, you know, what do you think about the same with Gilmore Girls?
You know, I'm super worried about it. I'm very, very yeah. worried about Twin Peaks. And
oh,
it's funny because I that review I did was, you know, very harsh. And in some ways, it's funny. I hear what you say, and maybe I lowered your bar for it. But part of me is like, I think you're being a little too generous about that first hour. I thought it was terrible. But, and I was a fan. And if we compared notes, maybe you were, and you had actually just seen Four, and you did an incomparable
for good, like hand-picked Four of
right.
the best.
So you were kind of maybe more back into it, where I didn't go back and do any prep work, shocker. And then,
well, I think it's terrible. I think what I'd say is it's terrible in the way that the classic X-Files was often terrible, which is like, so I was like, oh, it's bad in the same way that it was always bad. I got it, you know.
But right.
It's not very generous, but that's what it was. But, you know, like Twin Peaks kind of lost its way. I feel like it started to get good again right at the very end, but it hit most of that second season was just kind of meandering and pointless. And Gilmore Girls, you know, Amy Sherman-Palladino got fired basically, or walked off, and so the last season she wasn't even involved with, but she's back with this revival. So some of this, one of the challenges of having a revival is that you're kind of left with the hand you were dealt to a certain extent. And if you're picking up if you're picking up creatively from where you left off, I wonder if that puts these things really built to succeed? If the shows that they're reviving were kind of falling apart. I don't know.
Well, it's funny, cause I just to finish on that sentiment too, is I might have been, as much as I loved, X-Files, I might have been moved in a way as far as like, wow, look how great television is, that like I'd never been that way with any other show before Twin Peaks came along. So that might have had something to do with it. I might have been more of a Twin Peaks person, and so I am maybe slightly more worried about that one coming up. And
yeah.
And I think that there's so much reason why that one could really go badly. And I think that, you know, the delays in it and that one might be more dated because it might try too hard to be weird. So much stuff has become, I mean, think about it. So much weirder stuff has now happened after Twin Peaks invented weird and scary,
right?
It might have to break its back to get back to that level. And in doing so, we might all just think, oh, you're just trying too hard.
Yeah, it's a tough, Twin Peaks was so zeitgeisty too. It was so much like everybody got really into it, and then its moment passed. And I think that's a tougher thing to rekindle. At least the X-Files, I mean, it was whatever, 9 years. It was a much longer run, whereas Twin Peaks was this flash for a year basically, and then it was kind of done. And you're right, so kind of stylized and trying to be artistic in some ways while also being a soap opera in other ways. I don't know. I mean, it's not like they couldn't do a good job with it. It's just that's the concern, is how much are you paying service to the past versus trying to do something interesting? Because the point isn't to do something new, right? It's to do something new with something old. It's different. That's a different creative challenge, and it's more derivative. And I don't know. It's interesting to see this trend. You got to think that some of these revivals are going to be creatively successful. I don't think it'll be like all of them will crash and burn or all of them will fail, but I don't know how good the batting average is going to be.
Yeah, I'm not excited about it. I prefer newer stuff. Yeah. I think the nostalgia is a little hacky when it comes to art, but
well, I'm going to go to the British model again and say, you know, an occasional one-off special with characters, you know,
yes,
maybe that's a better, maybe that's a better play than trying to string back 13 episodes or 10 episodes or whatever of a show, because it's sort of done. But I don't know. I've been on the record before as saying I don't understand why NBC wouldn't take a bag of money to Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David and say, what do you say, 6 episodes of Seinfeld? Here's $1 billion. But you
Although those guys would say, you know what, we got change for that. You know,
Well, that may be, or they may say, sure, we'll take your $1 billion and then put out 6 episodes that everybody goes, oh yeah, it's not that good, right? I mean,
that's their style.
I don't know. Revivals. We're in revival mode now. We're in the revival era.
Yeah, I'm thumbs down on that.
Yeah, Yeah, I can. It sounds great, right?
I'll meet you halfway because I think you're right with the periodic one-off special, holiday special, little movie, little two-hour movie. I would go for that. Like if they did a two-hour X-Files movie, I would have been okay with that.
They did one of those in theaters, and it kind of two of them really, right. And it kind of crashed and burned.
But I know I saw them. That's the crazy part.
All right, we should talk about some. You reviewed a bunch of stuff. I mean, keeping in the theme of like some interesting premises that you reviewed this week. We should start with You, Me, and the Apocalypse, which I think we mentioned last time that you were going to review it, and your review is out now. This is that another post-apocalyptic comedy, Last Man on Earth, being the one that that premiered last year. How's this one?
I was very surprised. I liked it, and I thought, wow. And you know what? Actually, they did surprisingly well in the ratings. I was thinking about why I liked it too. It's so different than from anything else. It's an hour. I remember when I went to review it, and you know, part of the reason we opened this podcast with me punch drunk is it's just been insane. Both Dan and I have been working so many hours and so many episodes of TV lately. And it seems like all the big stuff is happening now. And there's a little sort of a slowdown in February. But as we'll get to in some of these ones, including Vinyl, which isn't even out yet. And I've watched, you know, a ton of that. There's just so many big shows, and I've been drowning in all this stuff and like losing sleep. So I wasn't prepared for like You, Me, and the Apocalypse. Like I wrote that day of, and I remember clicking on the trailer, not the trailer, the screener online and thinking, oh, it's an hour. That's literally what I did, you know, cause I had to watch a few of them and I was like, oh, I'm not prepared for this. I was hoping it was going to be 22 minutes. But, so even right from there, it's a comedy, quote unquote comedy in an hour. It's a British American co-production. And what I found interesting about it, as I thought about it after my review, was I think the reason I liked this so much was that it didn't feel like a bunch of Brits had come to the US and got into an NBC comedy. It felt like the Brits had made a British series and had invited some really good American actors to have fun in it. And then it aired later on American television, which is exactly how it was, because it's already aired in England. But it's funny. I really liked it. I know after the fact that some of my fellow critics really didn't like it. I don't know if I was an outlier or a lot. I never actually looked at it. But the people who saw it really loved it. I think it was super underrated quality wise, and I'm happy to say that it did pretty well, surprisingly well in the ratings, and maybe people were looking for something like that.
Its premise, which is that the world is going to end
In 34 days.
In 34 days, that's a fun one. Like how do people deal with the fact that it's all gonna end, and it's letting you deal with issues of kind of mortality, but on a much bigger canvas, and doing it as a comedy is pretty fascinating. I read there's a trilogy of detective novels called the Last Policeman series that is the same premise. It is a guy who's a cop, and then he ends up being a detective, and they find that an asteroid's going to hit the Earth and everybody's going to die, and you know it's basically a mystery or three mysteries set in a world that is unraveling because of the same premise. And it's interesting to see that. It's a I like the ambition, right?
Yeah, and really that's what it was. And you know, I'm sure we'll put links to the review. It's just felt like, wow, there's so much going on here. There's a number of storylines, there's mysteries and comedies. And the thing that I pointed out in the review that I think was smart for Ian Hollins, who created it, to do is that on the American side, their buddy comedy road trip element was a little more slapsticky, a little broader American. And the British one felt very British. It felt like two buddies out for a stroll and getting into problems and then kind of arching an eyebrow rather than, you know, flipping backwards over a hedge, which the American version would be. So there was a little something for everybody in there. And you can certainly catch up with that. I think you can find that on NBC.com, the first episode.
All right, cool. Let's see what else. 11/22/63. So based on the Stephen King novel, which I read actually when it came out.
I figured you did actually. I was looking to talk to you about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is James Franco starring. This is an interesting time travel story. Not your usual, like, it's not like there's a big Stargate or something that he steps through to go back in time. He goes into a closet in a diner.
Yeah, and as I know, I really loved it. And I think we were one of the – I mean, I think there's more out there now. We were one of the first, but they that was I was happy that that was a good, because I was looking forward to it. You know, you have so much big-time talent with Stephen King and J.J. Abrams and James Franco. And I did laugh that the only part of it that is kind of weak is that, I mean, you have to – all right, it's like an opt-in moment. He goes into a closet and pops out in 1960. Anytime you do – sci-fi, there's that moment, but I did kind of laugh that they do enough distortion tricks and look over here that you kind of forget, oh right, there's not actually a really good way to get back home. So they don't really tell you where you need to go, like on the one side you have to be in the diner and go in the closet to get out, but coming back apparently.
Well, in the book, you have to be where it drops you, which is in the or at the diner location in 1960 or whatever. You have to go back there, and basically there's a invisible portal that you have to step through.
But okay,
I can see why they would really finesse that.
Yeah,
right?
They finessed it because it's, you know, there's people standing around and people are talking to him when he's there. So if you were to pop into Nowheresville, maybe that was the problem. But yeah, they didn't really delve into that. But that was, to me, that was the only thing that I was slightly worried about. I didn't read it, the book version of it, but I was very happy with it. And as somebody who's sort of lukewarm to James Franco, I can take him or leave him depending on the role. He is amazing in this, and he really carries it. So much of this is on his back all the way through. Chris Cooper is great at the beginning as the diner owner / portal.
Yeah, portal.
He's a
portal owner. Been making, in the book anyway, he's been making the hamburgers with the same meat for years, because he just goes and buys the meat in the past.
Yeah,
it brings it back to the present. And then every time you go back, it resets. So you just buy the same meat again, because you keep getting dropped at the same time. It's not like the portal is moving ahead along with time in the present. The portal is always to 1960,
right,
which is kind of an interesting... The way Stephen King sends it up, this is a fantasy story, but it is not the kind of standard science fictional kind of time travel premise. It's a little bit different, which I like about the setting. And then I assume that the series will be very much like the book. You know, it's interesting because it's about the characters. It's about the James Franco character. He's kind of damaged. And, you know, and then who he meets in the past. And then you do get some of those classic tropes of, like, you know, am I going to be able to change history? History is pushing back at him. He falls in love in the past. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, I thought the book was fantastic. And the fact that there is this extra complication, which is you can go back, but you can't, like, dip back in and out. Once you go back, you're hitting the reset button. You've got to start from the beginning if you go back through the next time.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I like the way, because I didn't read the book, I like the way that is kind of... it's certainly implied. It's not one of those things where Chris Cooper, as the diner guy, keeps reminding him that, like, you know, like, this could be really bad if you do all this. And they leave that for the end, which I haven't seen all the episodes, and I'm excited to get to that point of the eight. But they did a great job, and I got to say, Franco is really good. And as I said in the review, the one thing that I think that he does well. And I appreciate it from a structure standpoint, is that he's not a cop or a, you know, private security guy or some kind of person who knows, who could go back and investigate and pull this off. He's a high school teacher.
Yeah.
And he's got to learn why he's there. And he doesn't know how to do much research, and he can't really follow people that well. And he's got to learn how to do it. And, you know, and he doesn't know how to use a gun, and he's not comfortable with it, and he kind of doesn't think about certain things, like maybe if he were a cop, and we've all seen so many cop stories, if something goes a little awry, then you kind of know when you've got to get out or you're in danger, and his character kind of doesn't know it until it's too late. And it's great, because it's he's back in a world he doesn't know anything about, really, and he's kind of he told him he would do it because his own life back home was kind of falling apart or going nowhere. So it's great. I think his facial expressions tell you, I'm not good at this, and this is new to me, and then now I'm learning as it goes along. So the subtle part of his acting is really impressive at that point.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. So that's Hulu. Interesting. Hulu original 8-part mm-hmm. series starting February 15th.
Yeah, and so good times.
Go Hulu.
Get all over that.
Looking forward to it. The Magicians, you got to review. Another series based on a book that I read.
I know. I was actually that one. I was kind of laughing because I was like, I'm getting into the Magicians territory where I know that people love the books, and you know, there's going to be people who are it's source material this and that, and they did this or they didn't do that right. I'm coming into it, I think, like most people will. I mean,
certainly this was not a best selling book. It is it was a fairly successful trilogy of fantasy novels by Lev Grossman, but it's not like the Harry Potter phenomenon or anything like that. It's just, yeah, you know, some people read them and liked them, like Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. I would say it's interesting source material, a book that was liked, but it's not like it was a number one bestseller or anything like that.
Okay, good. And I figured as much. I figured there will certainly be people who will come to it who haven't read it, but then, you know, every time you have source material, you're going to have a different opinion than someone like me coming in just to see the TV version.
Yeah.
And I liked it. I got to say, every bit of it that I watched, I kept thinking, this is production-wise better than I thought it was going to mm-hmm. be for sci-fi. This is acting level for most of these people who are – I mean, there's some established actors there, but on the younger characters, there's not. And I thought, these guys are better than I thought. They're not even – when you – sometimes actors can do certain roles and then you take them outside and or you put them on the run or something and it all kind of breaks down. And like, they're not that good at that. Everybody did kind of a wonderful job. I liked everybody's character. And I think every time I checked myself saying, hey, this is holding up better than I think. And it's got a little more here than I would have thought. Those are all good signs when you're a critic. You're kind of, you know, checking mm-hmm. your doubt at the door and rechecking it. And then I think that's a tribute to sci-fi did a really good job. And I found it really entertaining. And which I don't always with their shows. And I thought, well, I'll definitely come back and watch these for sure.
Yeah. It's, I saw the pilot because they streamed that early mm-hmm. and I haven't seen episode 2 yet, but, I thought it was really good. As somebody who's read the books, I thought it was really good, really well done. I know that some people are going to get upset about the fact that it's not the books, but that happens with every adaptation. In fact, listener Alan wrote in on, I believe on our Facebook page, and said, I get that The Magician works for you as a standalone series. As someone who's read the books, I think the changes they make really do a disservice to the source material. And this is what he says. First, it portrays the protagonist as someone with a destiny, but perhaps the key point of the book is that he wasn't the chosen. He had to choose what he wanted in life. Two, it makes the characters older. And Alan says the college age portrayed in the book is a better match for the book's theme of trying to figure out what one's identity and values are. And three, the TV show presents information in a very different order than the books, which spoils a lot of the surprises. Now, I will say I can see why, because of Alan's interpretation of the books, he might be disappointed. But I read the books and I disagree. I disagree with Alan's points. So sorry really? About that, Alan, but I disagree. I think we could argue about the destiny thing. I think that, it's a story and mm-hmm. the protagonist does what he does. And so you could argue that maybe it was his destiny, but he's not, you know, he's not necessarily a chosen one. And I think that's an okay argument, but it didn't bother me in the TV show at all. I think aging up the characters is fine, mostly because generally in shows like this, the actors who are playing them are older. Then yeah. It's very hard to get actors who are playing high school age people. And I think if you're going to have people who are going to be able to carry the weight of the series, having them be older and calling them older and having break bills be magic graduate school instead of magic undergraduate is, I think it's fine. I don't I don't have a problem with them being a little bit older, because I think that it serves the themes just as well in terms of their coming of age and trying to figure out who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of the way the show presents information, I'm going to say I think it's very much like The Expanse, another, I would say, successful sci-fi channel mining good book series for original material for a TV series. They are taking the entire universe and that was built up over many books and then trying to think of a good way to structure a TV series around it. So in the case of The Magicians, which is, it's funny because my wife has only read the first book and I read the first two. The way the TV series handles it, you've got this very interesting parallel between the character who is on the inside of the magical order of things, who is Quentin. And then you have Julia, who is kind of in the, with the kind of like all the people who can do magic, but are not officially blessed to do magic.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a great, interesting contrast between like the underground, not allowed or world of magic and the like highfalutin world of magic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In the books, Julia shows up at the end of the first book and it's sort of a plot twist. And then book two flashes back and tells you about how she got to be where she was. I think it's a valid and maybe better choice, because there's no way you're going to take season two of The Magicians, let's say, and rewind and tell her whole story in flashback. I think this is a much better approach, and you know, I think putting them in chronological order, although you lose the surprise, I think you gain from having the parallel, like I just said, of the sort of the legit world of magic and the illegitimate world of magic, and how these two people are walking very different paths as they learn about like how the magical world works, which I think was a really smart decision on that part. So I'm going to disagree with listener Alan, but I agree with you. Way better than I really had any hope for them doing it. And I think it's unfair to call it, it's Harry Potter where everybody drinks and has sex. But that's sort of it. That's how it starts anyway.
Well, and I also think that's the easy thing. Like I wanted to acknowledge that people were going to have the Potter connection, but I also don't, I mean, I've seen every Harry Potter movie and read the books. I didn't get that at all. I mean, it's magic too. And they're out of school, kind of like Hogwarts for grown up kids. So you're going to make it. But I think if you harp on that, it's just lazy.
Yeah. I mean, it is a really easy parallel to make, and it is true on a really basic level that's what it's about. It's sort of like a more realistic magic university, but that's about as far as it goes. I think the most interesting part of the premise to me is basically what if Narnia was real, because that's one of the funny things in it, is there's this concept of fillery, these books about this magic world of fillery that you can enter through a piece of furniture. Basically it is essentially Narnia, right. And in The Magicians, it's they find out that it's real. It's like a real place you can go to. Not only is magic real, that place that you read about in that book when you were a kid, totally real.
I know, that was clever. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
And not having read the book and having heard you sort of see how they did the Julia character, I absolutely agree with you that it wouldn't work the other way. You, as a television series, you can't do that. There's no way you first of all, it's really hard to launch a pilot episode.
Yeah.
And as we know in today with too much TV, it's really hard. And so you can't launch a series and establish it. If you're lucky and get viewers, then all of a sudden, you know what? Now we're going to flip it and
go back
to somebody else's coming of age story. Now, not happening.
Yeah. Well, and the juxtaposition, I think, works artistically. I think it's a really effective, like how Lost used flashbacks. I feel like the parallels between Julia and Quentin are really interesting, and rolling them together. And what The Expanse did is they took a great character who's introduced in the second book, Avasarala, played by Shora Egdashlu, and they put her in the first story. And, you know, essentially she's doing what that character was probably doing untold in the first book of the series, but not only do you add another woman to your cast, another non-white person to your cast, but you're also adding probably the best character in the book series up front. Why wait?
Exactly.
You know, just get all your best stuff in season one, because there may not be a season
two. There may not be one. Yeah,
exactly.
And I can tell you, I think that if you like that the pilot, which I did, the second episode is better.
Yeah,
because
awesome.
The first one suffers from, I don't think it suffers from anything. I actually enjoyed it. But if you're gonna compare it to the one that comes after it, you realize that, okay, well, we have to introduce you to the concept and all these people, and we've got to get everybody to break bills, and you know, we've got to try to do this and that, and it could be a little kind of corny. You got to go with it. Second episode's like, okay, you guys know all that, and now we're gonna build character, and it really is good.
Yeah.
So You'll like it, I think.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing more of it, but it's good. And thanks to listener Alan for writing in. Again, you know, we can disagree about that. I whenever you make an adaptation, you're making trade-offs. I was impressed by how they made changes that I thought would work to service it as a series. But, you know, I do like the books.
Yeah, and we're a believer in the reasonable people can disagree philosophy.
Absolutely.
Yes.
We love we love listener Alan, and thank him for posting on the Facebook page. So in a departure, you also reviewed New Yorker, The New Yorker Presents, which we should mention.
Yes, actually. You know, as a fan of The New Yorker who took it for many years, I was, and when they were at their TCA panel, I thought, wow, this looks kind of interesting. I want to see what they do with this. And so, yeah, the end result is, they did some interesting things, but, certainly not enough for you to go get Amazon if you don't already have Amazon, because I mean, and that's a whole separate issue. I laugh because I have Amazon, because of the shipping. And now I have the benefit of actually getting their TV shows as well.
Me too.
And I think that's how a lot of people fell into it. There may come a time when people are like, well, sure, I guess I would like second-day shipping for a year free. But, boy, I want those TV shows. So it could happen. So I just think that it's nice that they are doing a lot of strange and different shows and things and trying to be creative. But when it comes to The New Yorker Presents, it's you know, there's parts of it that are really good, and there are parts of it you can find anywhere on the dial, especially if you've had – it's almost like, oh, yes, The New Yorker people, maybe you don't watch a whole lot of TV. But this has been done a lot elsewhere. But the parts I liked, I really liked. I think they'll hone the concept, and Alex Gibney's Jigsaw Productions company is a very creative bunch, and I think they'll do a really good job of visualizing these New Yorker stories. I think that the problem that you run into is what I said in the review, and that is some of the stuff seems kind of half-assed. Like, and in one of them I said, I think it's like a quarter done. The story on Atlantic City was like, this felt like it needed a whole lot more story and a lot less and a lot more time that they didn't have. And so I don't know, in some ways, maybe it's if you want a better story, read it in the magazine, and then they'll conceptualize a visual version of that in a shorter bit for you to take in on the screen. But I just felt like, that's not it did some things justice, but other ones I was like, you need more time on this. So
you raved about Vinyl, what you'd seen of Vinyl at the press tour, and this is HBO, right? And now you've seen it. Now you haven't written your review yet, or published?
I did write it. Yeah,
it just hasn't gone up yet.
It hasn't gone up.
Can you give us a preview, a sneak spoilery sneak preview?
Yeah, tantalizing. Actually, technically, it comes out a day before 11/22/63. Oh. And the reason we did that review, by the way, and the New Yorker review, which also is in February, is because those made their premiere at Sundance. And THR's philosophy is that's the world premiere, and we need to cover it. So I wasn't at Sundance.
Yeah, you're just in your pajamas at home.
I was in my pajamas.
But you get to cover
TCA. Forget Sundance.
Yeah, but you got to cover Sundance from your pajamas
from my home. So. That's why that was. And we really want to be all over Vinyl when it comes out. And I'm happy to be doing it because of my love of music. And yeah, it was great. I think today some of the other episodes were rolled out to some of the other critics. I think we have a longer lead time than people. So I got to see a lot of episodes. I can tell you that I'm really happy because, you know, Scorsese does the first 2 hours, people may not know this, but it's technically a whole other unit. You know, Scorsese's got his people, he brings his squad with him when he makes movies and stuff. So they don't necessarily hang around for the future ones. So you have, there's plenty of other good directors out there, and. But the first person always sets the template, which is what he did for Boardwalk Empire as well, which is Terrence Winter's other series. But I wanted to see what it looked like the next couple of episodes. Like, what's the visual template going to be? Do they stick with this idea that it's a pretty big idea? And I like it a lot. I know why they did it. It might be a little jarring for some people, but The best way I can present it to our listeners is to, like, if you're it's one thing to, which they do in this series, is they clear a lot of famous music. They pay the money and they clear it. Whenever you see that happen, what's normally happening on the screen is, you know, you're watching Friday Night Lights or something, and a famous Wilco song or whatever is playing over the top of it, or it's just the right mood and feel, and maybe lyrically it adds to what you're witnessing, but you're witnessing the show, for example, Friday Night Lights or whatever you might be watching. And the music is an add-on, like an oral add-on, like floating in the cloud a little bit. But in vinyl, it was, I'm guessing, Scorsese's idea, because he set the template. Instead of having that be some like an ongoing scene, let's say between two characters in to convey this mood of like two characters in vinyl who are sitting in their kitchen and they've had an argument and a song comes on that's famous and they just kind of stare at each other and then they go about their life and you get the feeling of what is trying to be, you know, evoked in that moment. Instead of doing that, which is the interesting thing, they don't. They flip it out completely and they show you basically a mini video. And sometimes it takes place in that kitchen. Sometimes it'll take place in an office where the setting is. But it's a break. It is literally a break in the filming. And they'll do a little mini version of like some person, an actor, in this case, somebody playing Janis Joplin when they play Janis Joplin's song. Or it's there's a famous Bobby Blue Bland song that they use in one of the episodes. And it's an actor pretending to be Bobby Blue Bland when he was younger. And they show it almost like a little video, but it's a highly stylized, very colorful, interesting thing. And then they go back to the storytelling. It's really odd. And for me, that was the first thing I needed to see. Like, okay, that thing sticks out like a sore thumb. I like it, but like, do the rest of them have that? And they do. And it kind of messes with your head a little bit. This is kind of a little wonkery for music, but they do a really good job of, because they have a lot of money. And when you watch this, you can see money on the screen. I can tell you that. This does not look cheap. But it's kind of funny. The little part of my brain was like, oh, interesting financial decision. Sometimes they will pay for a Bowie song, which is interesting because I think it's the second episode or the third episode. I can't remember. Kicks off with Gene Genie, which is now really interesting because Bowie's dead, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure I don't think he was dead before they filmed it. In fact, I know he wasn't dead before they filmed it. So there's a Stones one. And of course, Mick Jagger is an executive producer. His son is a stars in this show. And so obviously you can get a Stones clearance. But other times they just have someone playing a famous song. And they're kind of close, right? Like when they do Velvet Underground, I backed it up and I was like, okay, wait. When they have a club scene where it's shot in Andy Warhol's in the factory downtown area, and it's obviously the Velvet Underground. And through three quarters of the song, I couldn't tell if it was the actual VU or not. And then when they got to a second song, I'm like, okay, that's not them. It's close, but it's not them. And it was really interesting. And for example, there's a scene where this woman who was part of that the Andy Warhol underground movement, she's married now to Bobby Cannavale, the main character in Vinyl, and she's got two kids and she's living in the suburbs and she's kind of longing for that lifestyle, and she flashes back to that. Well, when she's in the present, she's back with her kids in the suburbs basically having pancakes, so it's like And what they decide to do, and this is in the second episode, which I was found really interesting, was they play a Carpenter song. And because it's like, oh, right, you used to be like hanging out with the Velvet Underground, and now you're in the burbs, and here comes this, you know, 1972 Carpenter song, which is so not edgy. But at the same time, it's being covered by Amy Mann, who I love, and it's a great cover, but it's meant to be like, this is a little staid. And then they go one step further, Jason, in that they show the actress, Olivia Wilde, driving in the car, and they show an actress who looks just like Karen Carpenter lip syncing the Amy Mann song. So it's kind of 3 degrees removed. And so I'm telling you that there's really visually interesting. It won't work for everybody, but it's interesting. For me, I loved it because I loved all the music stuff. All the record labels in trouble, go out and find new bands, and what that meant in 1970, early 1970, 1972, and being in New York. And like, all right, your job is to like go out and find another band. Or like, okay, now tonight you have to go to this concert from one of our famous artists, and it's, you know, you're going to be drunk all over the place. That stuff was great. And I loved it. And I will watch the hell out of vinyl, and I give it a very, very positive review. Where it does slow down a little bit, and it's probably to be expected, is that they have other storylines. Everybody in the thing has a family. And when they get to those family moments, a crumbling marriage or depression, it's not as interesting. It's just not – you can't keep up the fact that you were just in a club with the New York Dolls, right? That's a thrilling moment, and the music is pounding, and you're thinking, okay, this is great. I want to see a show about this era in music. I don't necessarily want to see a story about a marriage crumbling. So they can't compete. And then I'm not giving anything away here because it's you know, it's certainly not solved or anything. But they made a decision to have an accidental murder happen in the pilot. And I don't know why they did that. I think if they look, I think they were thinking, well, we have to have all these other storylines. And they end up with tons of storylines. But I think when they were planning it, they thought, well, it can't all be about like life inside the record company. Let's have all this outside stuff happen. And I got to tell you, I think they're going to, that haunts it a little bit because it's like, really? You're dragging me back to a storyline that I don't really care about, this accidental murder and trying to solve it. I don't want to be there. I want to be in the club with the New York Dolls or the Velvet Underground. So I think the show works really well when it sticks to the music. That might be my bias, and works less well when it gets into traditional storytelling.
It sounds really interesting. It reminds me of season 2 of Friday Night Lights, right? It's like, hey, wouldn't it be fun if there was a murder that a guy dies and Landry and Tyra have to come? No. Mm-mm. Nope. Nope. Not what we watch the show for.
No, and people think that like really good shows can't make those kind of decisions that are mistakes. It happens all the time.
Yeah.
And you see it, you can feel almost like the sag by the 6th episode where they're like, oh, we should have never done this. And like, how do we get out of it? Like, can we just drop the story? Can this baby go away?
3 months later.
Right. Yes. They'll flash forward.
Everyone's
but I mean,
fine.
That's kind of funny to me. It's like, man, you spent a lot of time having that baby, but once it came out, you don't really want it around anymore. That's... I hope that that element doesn't drag down future, because there's 10 episodes in the first season. I assume it's going to be season long, but I hope it doesn't, you know, drag it down anymore. But the other side of the story I will say, Jason, is that just like, you know, you are a tech guy and, you know, there's sci-fi stuff that you're really interested in. I really love music. And
you're
maybe
a music guy,
this. Maybe I like this more than other people who will come to it and say, I didn't do it for me.
But it's in it's right in your wheelhouse, right? I mean, and it strikes me as being a show made for somebody like you who really, really loves music,
right? And I did struggle, and in the review, which I think we're going to put up Monday, by the way, because we want to be out there pretty early. In the review, people will eventually see that the part that I kind of struggled with is I am pretty open to all kinds of music. Yeah, especially if you're going to present it in this way where I'm reviewing it as a critic. But I don't know if people have the average person, if you're talking about will vinyl be successful or not, I don't know if people are interested in going all the way back to Bo Diddley and then punk rock. And, you know, do you like all those sounds? Maybe a little less on some of them. And when you focus on them, maybe you're not as interested. So I think that's one of the pitfalls that will face this show, even for music fans, is when they get to a segment of music you're not that interested in,
right,
do you just tune out?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Want to do some letters?
Let's do some letters.
All right. Dean from the 707, he's doing his bar and church in every state tour. We talked about that before.
But not Hobo Dean.
He's itinerant Dean.
Itinerant Dean.
So TV viewing in Nevada, Crime Story. In Arizona, Sky King. In New Mexico, Better Call Saul. Yes. You should have watched Alice in Arizona.
I don't know if I know what Sky King is.
It's a classic old-timey radio originally and then TV.
Gotcha.
Texas King of the Hill.
Okay.
And Oklahoma, Carnival.
The great unfinished mystery of Carnival.
Yeah. Keep up a good work, Dean, wherever you are.
That's good. All right. So he's out there on a road trip of epic proportions. Mm-hmm.
Bar, church, and TV show in every state.
I like it.
Our friend Indy Sarah tweeted with love from the 317.
Mm-hmm.
What's the word on American Crime Story? It will be huge, but is it deliciously cheesy or played straight? Is this the O.J. Simpson thing?
I think she said, well, it's interesting because
There's American Crime.
Right. Which is the ABC version played straight. I think she's referring, because she's using the word cheese, possibly to American Crime Story.
Yeah, that's what she said, is American Crime Story. So that's the People versus O.J. Simpson, right?
Yes. Uh-huh. And so it's, I would say it's played straight. And I haven't seen all the episodes because Dan Feinberg reviewed it. I think it's going to be a huge hit. And
wow.
I think it's going to be blockbuster level.
For those of us who lived through the O.J. Simpson trial, my wife said to me, she saw a promo for this, and she said, you know, I don't need to relive that.
You know what? I agree with her. And some of the casting, you're like, I mean, it's Ryan Murphy. As the executive producer, he's going to stunt cast the hell out of that thing. And he did. And I know Dan Feinberg certainly had some trouble with some of the casting, particularly Travolta, because he doesn't really think Travolta is really in the same film as everybody else. Mm. But other people don't have as much problem with Travolta. And maybe for some people I've read that OJ's a little bit weaker character for them, because they don't try to make Cuba Gooding Jr. look like OJ or even talk like OJ. He's just there. So I think there's a cheesy element, but as to your wife's reluctance to watch it, I would say that what I'm seeing anecdotally, from people who didn't have to review it for the series, mm-hmm. is that they didn't think they would like it, and then now they can't put it down, and they burn through all these episodes, and they're like, yeah, I didn't want to relive that, and now I'm fascinated that I did it. So I still think it's going to be huge.
All right. Mm-hmm. There you go, Indy Sarah.
Yep. I love this. I love Indy Sarah. Yeah. I miss her.
Mm-hmm. Also on Twitter, Big Drama wrote in and said, just to point out, because of last week's episode, Big Drama.
I love it. Mm-hmm.
Hollowed out dinosaur ship stuck in the mud. Which we talked about, that was the metaphor of last week.
Yes.
Basically, the plot of the second episode of Farscape. Accurate. Absolutely accurate. So thank you,
right?
Big Drama. Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Because
wow.
they kind of flew around space in a big hollowed-out dinosaur ship, essentially. So that's a good point. Good okay. knowledge. Good right. Farscape
well,
knowledge.
We thought we were punchy the last week coming up with that.
Early days of the Sci-Fi Channel. The things were weird then. I love Farscape. It had puppets. Space Muppets. You can't beat Space Muppets.
I did watch Farscape, yeah, it was good. I mean, I don't remember it religiously, but I did watch it.
It was a weird, weird show, but I liked it. Proudly Resents on Twitter said, from the 310, thank you, mm-hmm. the strangest cop, not a cop. And we actually got a couple notes about this, that Lucifer on Fox is cop, not a cop. There's a cop, and then there's the devil.
Yeah, and as luckily, I didn't have to review that. I did sit through the panel, though, at the Fox TCA event. But as Dan said, if you know the comic book, why would you do that?
Right, because the comic book has nothing. I mean, it's like he runs an underground like club or something. And here, well, no, let's have him solve crimes instead.
Right.
Sure.
As Dan says,
it's pretty much the same.
Why would you make a procedural out of the devil?
Oh.
But there you go.
It's the greatest cop, not a cop ever.
Yeah. He's the devil, but he solves crime.
Yeah.
As he would, I'm sure, be interested in doing.
Mm-hmm. Sure. For fun, for kicks.
For kicks.
Paul from the 631 says, I know a major chunk of cable prices are sports networks. How do you think sports networks and televised sports will come out to skinny bundles and cord cutting and things like that?
Well, they're. I mean, I think the most expensive channel is ESPN
yeah.
As far as getting money back. They're worried, and well, they should be, because, I think the one that could get the, I think Fox and some of the and MSNBC or NBC, some of those thought ahead when they did these regional networks, because if you do a regional network, you're just going to get like Giants and A's and mm-hmm. Warriors, and that's all you have to watch. It may not be SportsCenter, may not have a thrill of that or big picture thing, but I don't know. I, for one, if I wasn't having my stuff paid for by the company, I would definitely be not having cable, and I would do these bundles. What I would miss is that because I dislike ESPN so much now, that as a fan, I like watching stuff. Well, I watch on CSN Bay Area, so there's your regional story. Yeah. But I like the just going to the channel owned by the network, I mean the league, you know, like the NFL.com, you know, channel.
NFL Network, MLB yeah. Network, yeah.
MLB Network, they do a great job just covering that one sport, you know. NHL Network, I just go there. So I don't go to ESPN.
All the money right now is in sports TV because they view live sports as the leverage to keep people on cable. And, you know, you're right. I was thinking, what would I do if I wanted to cut the cord? What would be the issues? And the number one issue is live sports, especially baseball. Sports. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, if at some point the move, it will happen so quickly that, you know, the cable companies will turn around and say, essentially make a lot of these cable companies own the regional sports networks, right? So they'll say, okay, well, you can not pay for cable and instead pay for our baseball channel, but right. it's going to cost you $30 sure. a month or something yeah. like that. And it's not going to save this. It's what always comes back to when we talk about cord cutting, which is in the end, everybody's going to get paid. So yeah. cord cutting is great, but cord cutting is not going to prevent you from spending money. If you want to watch sports, you're going to have to spend the money.
Right. And I think yes, and you're so right about that. I think the early critical take on cord cutting and sort of cobbling together these little mini bundles was that, oh, you're just going to end up paying more than you did for your cable channel. And I don't think that's true. I think what mm-hmm. Yes, it could be true on the surface, but I think what will happen, it'll force people to make decisions.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I guess I don't get to see that, but I can still see Netflix and Acorn and, you know, whatnot over here and Hulu. So maybe that happens. And I don't know if I'm just throwing this out, by the way, but I would think it would be really interesting if there's a total meltdown in the cable bundle in the future, which there will be, of course. But I would actually pay an interesting amount of money, which I won't say here because I'd have to see if it could ever come together. Boy, if you put the NHL channel and the NBA channel, if you put all those channels on one bundle, I'd buy that. Hmm. Depending on the pricing.
Yeah, I think I think you're right. What it's going to be is Comcast, you know, for example, wants you to just kind of go all in and just like get yeah. TV, and you've got all the TV, and it feels like we're going to end up in a world where there are sort of 15 TV products yeah. and everybody's going to pick 2 to 6 of them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's just how it's going to be. It's yeah. kind of fractured.
And you know what, Jason, you might be a guy who whatever they offer, you know, maybe you won't pay if they jack up a regional sports bundle because they own it. But you might be a guy who says, all right, you know, I want to see, would love to see like a Cubs game or something. I'll watch it at the local pub.
That's possible. I mean, I would definitely pay. I mean, there's no doubt if I was a cord cutter and they said, well, you can be a cord cutter and you can still watch the Giants, and here's how you do it. You pay us $120 every yeah. year. Mm-hmm. I'll pay it.
Yeah.
Sign me up, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we're not there yet because Comcast will pay more to be the regional sports network that's only available on cable. More than this is where it gets scary for sports networks, I feel like, or for sports leagues and teams, is yeah. I think their TV money is overinflated because it's being used as leverage to keep people from cord cutting.
Yeah.
And at some point, if the cord cutting accelerates, the air is going to come out of the balloon because they're going to lose their audience if they don't provide a streaming version of that. But the economics aren't priced for that. The economics are priced as leverage against cord cutting.
Yeah, that is so true.
And that's when this is when people always ask, like, why can't I watch in market games? I always point to the Dodgers TV deal where, you know, they made this deal that's worth, you know, billions, you know, like tens of billions of dollars, and it goes for 30 years. It's like, that's why you won't be able to do that because a cable company has made a deal to lock in the Dodgers because they want to make you have to get cable to watch the Dodgers.
Yeah. Crazy, right?
Yeah. So I don't know. That's going to be, you know, the interesting moment will be when it's no longer plausible for that to work, where the leverage is gone. And then they're going to be like, oh, geez, we should probably make a product for streaming now so we don't lose this audience. But
And then that flashes back to my thing about how the little small ones are going to go bye
because
they were only around to provide filler to have you have to have it because then you can get all these channels. Yeah. Not anymore.
Continuing story, I'm sure we'll talk about it more as time goes along.
Story.
Dave in the 407 wrote in. This is a good one. Jason mentioned that he's watching most Mozart in the Jungle after the Golden Globes, and that reminds me of Not a Thing. I've been meaning to send in for a while. I'm a classical musician and composer, and there are so many things that TV and movies regularly get wrong about my field. Actors fake playing instruments is usually pretty bad, but with the exception of the terrible fake conducting from Bernal and McDowell, the actors in Mozart actually do pretty well. My wife and I were talking about this. We theorize that it's probably like there's a certain number of the actors in that show are actually just musicians, and then there's a certain number of them who are probably like actors who used to play music, and then there's like the ones that they really need good actors for. Just like, how do you cast it to make it seem mostly right? But it's good to know that they do pretty well. So Dave goes on, however, the thing that drives me craziest is when I hear TV musicians refer to somebody as being the first chair in an orchestra. Stop the madness. Nobody has been first chair in anything since high school. The word chair is not used, it's not a thing, as the title of any professional ensemble. The top player in an orchestra is the principal. The one after her is the assistant principal, and everybody else is a section player. Calling someone first chair makes you sound like a dilettante. Speaking of Mozart, there's a great cameo joke in the season 2 premiere that you might not notice if you don't follow classical music. As Rodrigo is about to take the stage as a guest conductor with the Los Angeles Philharmonic at the Hollywood Bowl, a stage technician of some kind whispers to him that he should leave New York and take a position with them in LA. He says, come save us. We hate our conductor. The technician is being played by Gustavo Dudamel, the current conductor of the LA Philharmonic, and the person Bernal's Rodrigo character is based on. Very good knowledge, Dave. Well done.
Wow, that letter. God, that was good.
Some classical music knowledge. Dave, you are making this podcast way too classy, way too intelligent.
You just...
Make it stop.
Well, he didn't drop the mic. He would have just delicately replaced it on its stand.
Yeah.
But, you know, I actually have thought about that, but it's great. Like, I will never have the musical chops in that area to ever say, well, that's... just arms waving around. It must be crazy if you can actually play music to look at that and think, what are you doing?
I think what I would say to Dave is the reason that conductor stuff is totally crazy is because as somebody who doesn't know anything about it, when I see real conductors, I go, come on, that's totally fake. And then I see it in the show and I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever. It's just as ridiculous because I cannot tell any difference between what they're doing. So it's good to know that the conductors are fake, but the players do a pretty good job. Not a thing.
I love that. Yeah. Can't,
first chair.
It obviously cannot be faked, but we don't know. So it all looks real.
Dave, you can be our first chair letter writer anytime.
I love it. Yeah.
Couple more. Sean from the 409 writes in, I think that's Texas. Thanks for talking about Angie Tribeca. I hadn't heard a peep about the show until you brought it up. I watched it this past week and absolutely loved it. Aside from this podcast, what do you think is the best way to find out about new shows these days? It seems like we need a modern version of the old Entertainment Weekly magazine, still being published, by the way, to gather all the new TV information and get it out to mainstream viewers. I'm suffering from the peak TV version of fear of missing out.
Yes.
Thanks for your podcast, Sean from the 409. I sent this letter to you and I said, this is our big new business model, is what to watch on TV magazine. Mm-hmm. We could call it something like TV Guide. I don't know. I don't know how we'll work on that.
That was very funny. Yes, I like his FOMO about Peak TV. That's good. Yep. We all have that. And you know what? I actually don't have a fear of missing out. I have a fear of actually having to cover more of it. But I will say that, like, The Magicians, right, and You, Me, and the Apocalypse are perfect examples of, boy, I like those shows, and I would have never watched them.
Mm.
Never. And periodically, if I wasn't in the business, probably wouldn't have heard much about it. Even being in the business, I didn't hear much about You, Me, and the Apocalypse. So it is kind of hard in some ways. And I get that he's probably not like a Twitter person. I because some people are just not online. They're not connected. They don't want to do any social media. But boy, I got to say, if you take the word social media out of Twitter, that's how you get your news and your information. You just curate it to your likes, and then you would never miss it because it'll be tweeted out constantly with links.
Yeah. The websites cover this really well. I mean, HollywoodReporter.com/television will have, between you and Dan and your freelancers, you will review basically everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, besides this podcast, I would say, you know, that's a good place to start. Little THR plug there.
Yeah, that's a THR plug, which is necessary. Sometimes we just joke about it, but it's, you know, we're up again for a National Magazine Award, and we're going to be going up. Well, I think we're two different categories. We're going to be going up against four of the great all-time magazines. So we're in the heavy hitters this year as well. But if we do, I'm more tooting my own horn or our own horn, but the industry is pretty much covered at the Hollywood Reporter, wherever you want movies or television. You just click on the TV thing and you'll get more information than you'd ever want it.
Nice. One more letter. This is Brady in the 801. Brady says
801.
801.
Alaska?
Can you do that? No, that is Utah.
Close.
Close. Oh, yeah.
That's my joke for the
Western Hemisphere. Good.
Thank you.
So week after week, you guys go over all the wonderful scripted shows that you love. But after reading Tim's Making a Murderer review, I have to ask, what are your favorite non-scripted shows? I know the late night talk shows must be near the top, but for me personally, I'm a huge fan of Nathan For You on Comedy Central, still strong in the third season. P.S. Greatest Not a Cop Yet goes to Making a Murderer, as millions of people on social media now fancy themselves to be cops.
Yes,
zing.
Very good.
So unscripted?
Yes, I didn't actually review that, though. That was Dan.
Oh, that's not what I meant, but yeah. Who did Making a Murder.
Yeah.
Oh,
he,
yeah, well.
He reviewed Making a Murder.
Yes, sorry, Brady, you missed it by that much.
That's
But that's okay. He's in Alaska.
When I tweet it out, people just click it and they don't look at who did it. And they're like, oh, you wrote that. I'm like, no, actually, no.
That's okay. So what are your favorite non-scripted? Do you have any particular favorites?
My favorite non-scripted show in history is Top Gear.
Oh, yeah.
That's my number one show. That's my number one non-scripted. Probably my second favorite that's not a current current late night show is How It's Made on the Science Channel.
Hmm.
I think, as I've said many times to my students, it is the greatest hangover series ever created. It's fascinating. You can watch multiple episodes in a row, and the voice narrator never, ever fluctuates above the same. He's never low. He's never below his standard. He's never above it. He is constantly it's the same monotone delivery. So you don't feel a headache. He doesn't yell. It's just beautiful. There's no ads. It just comes down. It's just make three things. I love it.
Hmm.
Other than that, I think talk shows. So Daily Show, an old version. I don't like the new version. And now it's these like five great late night talk shows that we have. Because it was Colbert and it was Stewart. Those were my bang bang ones, but now it's all this whole thing of late night talk shows. But unfortunately, because there's like five of them, I now just wait until my inbox sends me all the highlights, so I don't have to watch them at night.
Yeah, I'd say Colbert. I still dip in on quite frequently. Last year, my favorite, I would say, is The Jinx. That was a really good find.
Oh yeah, that's something else, boy.
Yeah, that was.
Still.
That was nice. And then, and traditionally, you know, reality stuff, I kind of have stopped watching reality stuff, but Amazing Race was always good.
Yes,
I really liked the first few years of Survivor. I feel like eventually that game, even though they try to put rules changes in, essentially once you've seen it and once enough people in the world have seen how it's played, it sort of just gets repetitious. But I really loved the strategy. You know, we would just pause the DVR and talk strategy during Survivor. It was like the most engaged I think I've ever been with a TV show, trying to figure out what the right play was. So, although I would say my number one, my favorite non-scripted, it's sports. Sports is my number one non-scripted.
Yes.
You know,
that's
whether it's Steph Curry throwing a three down from like 80 feet away, or it's Buster Posey at bat, or it's the Chargers moving in vans to Los Angeles in the middle of the night, something like that. You know, sports, the sports.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. So. I hadn't thought about it in that way, but you'd definitely be right about that.
But that's in there. There's so many different kinds of non-scripted. Right? There's reality and there's documentary and there's so many different kinds. But.
I think your point about Survivor's interesting because I agree with you wholly on that. But there is a subset of people who still to this day are watching Survivor and still find it, you know, as good as it has ever been.
If I had more spare time and there wasn't so much else great TV on, I would probably still be watching it and The Amazing Race because, you know, it's fun and the gameplay aspect of it. When I sour on reality shows, it's when it becomes less about the... There's a moment with reality shows where they realize and the people on them realize they're so aware of that on a TV show.
Yeah, they're characters. They're just playing a role now.
And then they just are giving the audience what they think the audience wants. Mm-hmm. And that's not what I want as an audience member. I want them to be kind of in the moment and be themselves and see them as that. And that was another problem with Survivor and The Amazing Race, is that after a while, people are like, oh, I'm going to be the heel here. I'm going to be Richard Hatch and I'm going to cause trouble and I'm going to double cross people. And then it becomes, you know, much less interesting for me as somebody who sort of like wants to see people playing a game, because then the people aren't playing games anymore.
Yep.
Playing the game, they're just trying to be famous, and that's not interesting to me. Mm-hmm. So
totally,
you know,
agree.
But I would probably still be watching those shows to a certain extent if there weren't so much great stuff on. And that for me, I feel like that's one of the things that too much TV does to my TV viewing, is it pushes a lot of stuff that is perfectly fine junk.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a time I could justify watching it. And now I can't. The existence of all this good stuff, I can't justify most unscripted stuff because there is so much great scripted stuff.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, and because that sentiment of like how this too much stuff has changed what you're even able to allow yourself, it kind of dovetails with I can't remember his name. The question about where do I find out about all these great shows on television. And then us or me saying, you know, boy, THR's got more than you need. I would just like to alert people that we have links for things as obscure, and I'm not kidding you. I'm looking at them right now. What's leaving HBO now for February 2016? What's leaving Showtime February 2016? So like, and what's leaving Hulu and leaving Netflix? Like, it's there's so much that you can actually control, like what you're missing. And you've put off, like, I know this is on Netflix and I'll get to it eventually as a movie. And then somebody says it's leaving next week. But so people are actually tracking that because there is too much stuff and things get pushed around and we have less ability to stay stagnant.
Yeah, it's hard to keep track. So much information.
It's too much information.
So much. All right. Well, I think we've done it. I think we've contributed to the information glut for the week.
We did. We glutted it up. I would like to say that I rallied from my giggles and my brain dead giggles. I had a
strong rally
after a very long nap after watching shows until 3 a.m. and then getting up and at 6:30 and going and doing it again. So I'm back.
Well, then it's time to say goodbye. Thanks to everybody out there for listening. As always, you can give us feedback, podcast@tvtalkmachine.com. You can go to Facebook, facebook.com/tvtalkmachine. You can tweet at us at TVTM. I'm at Jay Snell on Twitter. Tim is at Bastard Machine on Twitter. And so there's so many ways that you can find us and tell us things. And then we'll try to read your letters on the show. And we'll be back next week where perhaps we will giggle again. Tim, see you next week.
Okay, bye.